on collaboration with various people, namely Ralf Blumenhagen, Curio, Lars Görlich, Albrecht, who is here, Boris Kurs, and Stefan Theisen. So as you probably have heard of many times, string compactifications with internal background fluxes provide you an interesting class of string vacua, and there are several possibilities which occur, and some of them which we will discuss. Namely, for example, you can consider type 2 compactifications, type 2A or type 2B on, say, K3 times T2 or Calabi-Yau 3 folds. And then you can turn on fluxes in the internal space of the field strengths, H fields in the Ramond or in the Nibel-Schwarz sector, which means that you have an H field with indices in the internal space, and you integrate this over some n-dimensional cycle, say, of your Calabi-Yau threefold. Or if you go to heterotic or type 1 strings, compactified, say, on a 6 torus or on K3 times T2, you can consider abelian gauge fields, F, which arise naturally in the string series. And you can also integrate them over, say, T2 or P1. And this provides you the so-called fluxes of internal magnetic fields. Now, these background fluxes can cause many interesting effects after compactification. So they induce, in general, supersymmetry breaking. They induce a scalar potential, and the minima of the scalar potential are, in general, non-supersymmetric, or break at least part of the original supersymmetry. Then they reduce the gauge symmetries by various methods. For example, there arise also green Schwarz terms, which break some part of the abelian gauge group in general. They may generate chiral fermions, which is, of course, very important from the phenomenological point of view. And there's also the relation between background fluxes and warped spacetimes. It was, for example, discussed recently by these authors. So in my talk, I like to discuss or focus a little bit more carefully first on the type 2 string compactifications, as we call it, on non-commutative spaces, and the dual picture, which contains D-branes which intersect certain angles. In particular, I would like to pose again the question, can one obtain the standard models from this class of string compactifications? I hope that this question is also appreciated here, how to get the standard model from strings. And then I will switch to the other type of background fields, the H fields, as we call them, and analyze them in type 2 vacua, and also pose the question whether the celebrated type 2 heterotic string duality is still preserved in the presence of background fluxes. So let us start with the type 1 compactifications. And to be specific, we consider a type 1 string with D9 branes, where we turn on now internal magnetic background fields, FKL. And as it is well known by now, if you have D-branes with fluxes living on the world volume on the D-branes, then your space becomes non-commutative. So the picture is here that due to the fluxes, our internal space becomes non-commutative. And to make life simple, we will consider now the simplest possibility, that we consider the product of three of these non-commutative two tori. Of course, this could be also done for more complicated spaces like Calabi-Yau spaces. But this serves, so to say, as a most simple and basic example. And okay, we have this non-commutative two torus. and the non-commutativity of the toroidal coordinates is expressed in terms of a parameter theta. As usual, j goes from 1 to 3, so it labels the 3 tori. And in terms of the background fluxes, there's this relation between the non-commutativity parameter and f. You might ask, what is the reason to consider these non-commutative internal spaces? And there are various phenomenological advantages of these backgrounds, which I have already mentioned a few. And if you compare the commutative, the simple normal commutative torus with the non-commutative one, you know that for type 1 strings, we have 16 supercharges, so n equals 4 supersymmetry, if you have just an ordinary torus. We have non-chiral fermions, and you get, in general, a large gauge group, say, of rank 16. On the other hand, if you turn on these background gauge fields, supersymmetry on the D-brains will be broken. So this is an example of brain worlds with broken supersymmetry on the brains. But the closed string bulk will be still supersymmetric. You can obtain indeed chiral fermions. And I will show you that you can build, in fact, models where 3 generations are possible. And also, the fluxes break the gauge groups, so you get smaller gauge groups. And again, I will show you that one can build models which precisely lead to the standard model gauge group. I will discuss you. It will have 2 contributions, one closed string contribution from the NS2 form and one open string contribution, so abelian gauge fields which live on the brains, so a closed string plus an open string contribution. And the more important piece is the open string contribution, as you will see. Well, there are 2 values for the NS2 form allowed, namely 0 and 1/2. So it has to be discrete, as I will show you. The NS2 form will not be anymore a continuous parameter. In this sense, you are right. Correct. So the fluxes will be quantized, as you will see. Just let me also indicate you a little bit what these internal non-commutative spaces mean. They certainly don't mean that in the effective four-dimensional field theory, you have a non-commutative Young-Mills theory. So in other words, your effective field theory is still commutative. But it means essentially that the moduli space of these field theories, if you start with an n equals 4 theory, becomes non-commutative. And this one can see with a little example. Say we start with an n equals 4 super Young-Mills gauge theory, which contains 3 adjoint chiral superfields, phi I. And these 3 superfields are in one-to-one correspondence to the 3 complex internal coordinates of the torus. And now add to the theory some deformations in form of this kind of superpotential. Here the first 2 terms, when Q is 1, is the standard n equals 4 superpotential, which preserves all the supercharges. But then you can also add different type of cubic terms. You can add mass terms, and you can also add linear terms of this form. And n equals 4 supersymmetry is only preserved for q equal 1 and for 0 values of the other parameters. Then you can analyze what is the vacuum manifold, which is defined by the superpotential. Just analyzing the equations dw over d phi equals 0. And this leads to these 3 equations, which are, so to say, deformed commutators, and where you see clearly the non-commutativity in the internal space. And in fact, there's a little bit more structure. So if there would be only these linear terms, we get the so-called canonical structure. There are only constant deformations. For the case of the mass terms, there are linear deformations, so linear in the fields or in the internal coordinates. This is called the so-called Lie algebra structure. or for cubic deformations here and here, you get quadratic deformations, which is a so-called quantum group structure. And for the time being, we will only consider these canonical deformations. But later on, I think if one comes to the H-field in the H-field background, in the context of the Calabi-Yau spaces, you get essentially also the possibility of having linear deformations. So this will be then related to the fuzzy, so-called fuzzy sphere, essentially. Why is it useful to think about?
You're not going to get exposed in the first part to this algebra. You're already limited to flow. And I'm giving an example given with a concrete presentation of this algebra by matrix of concrete size. Why is it
useful? Well, I don't know whether I mean useful in what sense. I think it is just a structure which arises here. And if you like, you can compute the star product and quantities like this in the internal space, and you will see that it's non-trivial. So indeed, the internal space is a genuine non-commutative space, but okay, I don't know whether this, this answers your question or not. Well, I mean, you can also phrase everything in terms of these background magnetic fields, which is fine. There's also a T-dual picture, which we will discuss. But okay, this is some additional information, I think, which is interesting in my mind. Okay, so to start this, let us consider first one of these three two tori. And the background parameters which characterize these two tori are essentially are given by the two radii, R1 and R2. And there's also the closed string field B. But as it was asked already, these B field we will set to discrete values. So we will allow only the values 0 and 1/2 for the B field. And we choose also the torus to be rectangular. So this angle, this parameter alpha is set to 90 degrees. Then now we add different open string sectors. So we now include D2 brains. And in fact, we can introduce various D2 brains, which are labeled by the index mu. So k different sectors of D2 brains. With additional gauge flux f mu. And as you probably know, introducing these fluxes, the D2 brain is not really a D2 brain anymore, but it possesses mixed Neumann Dirichlet boundary conditions of this form, where the parameter curly f, which determines the boundary conditions, is given by the sum essentially of B divided by R1 times R2 times now the open string background F mu. And both of these parameters have to be quantized in units of 1 over R1 times R2, namely the parameters which determine the open string background F mu are the so-called magnetic charges of the gauge fluxes mu, which have to be integer, and these are nothing else as the so-called churn numbers of the bundle, which of the U1 bundle, which lives on the torus, and also electric charges mu, which tell you how many times the D2 brain wraps around the torus, and then you get this expression where m and n should be, of course, coprime to each other. Or if you combine it in this way, you get an effective churn number m twiddle, which is just the sum of m plus b n. And this mu twiddle now can be integer or half integer, depending whether you choose b equal to 0 or 1/2. And the non-commutativity parameter of the torus is just then determined by the curly f in this way. You can also apply a t-duality, say, in the x2 directions, and t-duality means that you exchange the sigma by the tau derivative with respect to x2. So let's do this. So here we have the mixed Neumann-Dirichlet boundary conditions, and you see that after applying the t-duality, the D2 new brain with F flux is now mapped to a D1 brain. So these are the boundary conditions of an honest to God one-dimensional D1 brain, but which intersects the X1 axis by some certain angle, phi mu, which is just determined by the fluxes in this way. So in other words, we get D1 brains after the t-duality, which are wrapped around the one cycles of the dual torus. And this is again depicted in this way for an example where we have chosen little n and little m to be 1, comma 1. And here are the two cases. First, where the B field is 0. And if the B field is 0, the dual torus is also rectangular. But in case that the original B field is 1/2, it means that the dual torus is now tilted. So this tilt of the dual torus precisely corresponds to B equal 1/2. And if you project, so to say, the winding numbers and the two winding numbers on the x1 and x2 axis, you see also the meaning of this effective winding number and Whittle, which I have introduced, which can be, which is half integer for this case. So you see that the non-commutative torus, which is well known, is equivalent by some SL2Z transformation to a commutative one, which is a kind of Morita equivalence. And which picture you're using is essentially up to you, whether you like more the non-commutative description in terms of fluxes or the commutative description where you have brains which wrap cycles of the dual torus. This is up to you, and for many applications, the dual picture is even more transparent because you get nice geometric quantities, as you will see. So now, to construct say four-dimensional orientifold models, we compactify the type 1 string. Let me remind you that type 1 string is just the type 2 B string divided by the Rorschach orientation symmetry omega. And instead of 1, 2 torus, we consider 3 non-commutative tori with background parameters Bj, R1j, and R2j, as it should be here. And we add now n mu d9 brains, so k sectors of d9 brains with fluxes m mu j. In the t-dual picture, this means, of course, we apply t-duality in all x2 directions, that we now have m mu d6 brains with three different angles on the three two toroi. In other words, the six brains are wrapping the three cycles of the six-dimensional torus. And as I have told you in the beginning, all this can be then also translated, I think, if you consider internal spaces which have more structure, like Calabi-Yau spaces. Yes. This is what is meant here. Every sector, in principle, is labeled by different flux quantum numbers, and this will come out, turn out to be important. So there's not only a D9 brain of one certain type, but there are k different D9 brains. Each of them is labeled by a pair or three pairs of electric and magnetic charges, N and M, or angles, phi mu. Right. Yeah, we will come to this. We will see that the spectrum precisely. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. There's one important point one has to mention, namely in the t-dual picture, this Rorschach parity gets also combined with a reflection in all x2 directions, which means that it maps the D6 brain, or certain D6 brains, which is labeled by these two quantum numbers, to a D6 mirror brain where all the integers n are appear with a minor sign. So if you have this originally six brain, the mirror brain is defined by this pair of integers or by this angle. Okay, so let us come then to the open string spectrum in four dimensions. And to get a better understanding, let me compare the supersymmetric configuration, which preserves maximal supersymmetries for 16 supercharges, with a generic configuration. So for the supersymmetric configuration, we have a stack of 2n D9 brains with zero fluxes, or in the dual picture with zero angle. And here, from the open strings which stretch around the various D9 brains, you get full vector multiplets, or in other words, the gauge group is given by SO2n. However, a generic non-supersymmetric configuration, which breaks, in fact, all supersymmetries now, looks like this. You have k stacks of n mu D9 brains with fluxes m mu. So here's a D9 brain with index mu, and here's a, or this is better shown now in the T-dual picture, D6 brains with angle mu, and another D6 brain with angle mu, plus their mirror brains with angles mu prime and mu prime. And now, first of all, the gauge group will be not anymore given by the orthogonal groups, but the unitary group, so you have a product of k unitary factors, n equals 1 to k of mu and mu, where n is, as usual, the number of these different brains. Second, besides the gauge degrees of freedoms, you get also now fermions, and as I've promised to you at the beginning, in general, these fermions will be chiral. And the fermion representations are first given by bifundamental representations, which corresponds to open strings which stretch from one brain mu to another brain with index mu. Then you get also brains which stretch from mu to the mirror brain mu, and these are n representation. And then you get also open strings which stretch between a brain and its mirror image. And there are, in fact, two types of those representations, namely anti-symmetric representation and anti-symmetric plus symmetric representations. And the interesting thing is that the number of these chiral fermions, of these fermions, are given in terms of the intersection number of the brains. And this is, I think, quite understandable, because these open strings, they sit precisely at the intersection of the brains, because they should be massless. So it is precisely the intersection number which counts all these representations. And you see this here is, again, the example of a two torus. And now you have to bring back every D1 brain to the unit cell, and then you can count simply how many times the brains intersect each other. And this is relatively easy to do. And the answer is given in this little table, where we have also taken the product over the three tutori, in particular for the bifundamental representation n, n, and n bar, n. You get these two types of formulas. Note, if you want to get really chiral fermions, say, for example, with respect to the first, or with respect to this UN gauge factor, you have to require that the difference of I minus I prime has to be an odd number. Then, now, first of all, it has to be non-vanishing, and moreover, if you want to get an odd number of chiral fermions, it requires that some of these closed string B fields have to be non-zero. Otherwise, you will always get only even number of generations, so to say. And this is, of course, important if you want to build models with three generations at the end.
How do you distinguish between the left moving and
Okay, in this table I have only written down the left moving while spinner. So everything is left moving here, and you see, for example, if you want chirality, say with respect to the first new n factor, it is precisely given by the difference of I mu nu, which are the brains which go from brain mu to the brain nu, minus I mu nu prime, which counts the number of brains which go from which counts the number of open strings from mu to the mirror of nu. So it is this difference essentially which is a chiral index. You can show this also by different means. So this difference has to be zero, non-zero, in order to get chirality. Now, as you know, the number of brains and also these choices for the magnetic fluxes are not arbitrary numbers in string theory, but they are essentially determined by the conditions of vanishing Ramon tetpoles. So what one has to do, one has to compute, as usual, the non-oriented one-loop amplitudes, the Klein-Bottle, the annulus, and the Möbius strip, and this then provides you four so-called tetpole conditions, namely, so to say, one overall tetpole condition, which tells you that the negative Ramon charge of the orientifold we have introduced has to be cancelled by the D brain, and then also the so-called five brain charges, the five brain conditions, if you project, so to say, the brains on the directions orthogonal to the orientifold plane in the T-dual picture. So you get in total these four equations, and these four equations in fact just ensure the absence of non-abelian anomalies in the four-dimensional effective gauge theory. So if you want now to do a model search, you think about what configurations correspond to the gauge group of the standard model, and what kind of intersection numbers precisely give you three generations of quark and leptons. So these are, if you wish, the input data, and then you have to see whether this input data can be indeed realized by this microscopic string data, which are capital N and these three pairs of numbers, mu j and mu j. So this search now can be done, and okay, I will not explain it very much. It's a little bit cumbersome, and one uses perhaps best computer program. But it will turn out that the minimal choice, at least if you want to have all standard model fields from these bifundamental representations, is that you need four stacks of D6 brains, or in the commutative picture, you need at least four stacks of D9 brains, where N1 is equal to 3, and 2, and N3 is equal to 2, and N4 is equal to 1. This is at least the example we discuss in our paper. This gives you, as a gauge group, U3, obviously corresponding to N1 equal to 3 times U2 square times U1. And as I've told you, in order to get three generations, one of the B fields at least has to be one non-zero, which means one half. And you have chosen to that the B field with respect to the second torus is one half, but this is of course a little bit arbitrary. And then you will see that consistent choice of Rapley number is given by this set of integers. And it's not then not so difficult to check that you get precisely this spectrum, which constitute three generations of quark and leptons with respect to a left-right symmetric standard model, left-right symmetric model, where you have also a right-handed SU2. And you see also here that you have a priori four U1, four abelian U1 factors, but this is in fact not completely true, because you see after investigation that in fact two of the U1s are anomalous, which means that the corresponding gauge bosons get a mass by the so-called Green-Schwarz mechanism. Maybe there's a coupling between the B field and the four-dimensional gauge field strength. And it turns out that the anomaly-free combination, or one of the two anomaly-free combinations is just the U1B minus L, which is, I don't know whether you know it or not, which is needed for this left-right symmetric model to be the correct abelian factor. No. I hope I made it clear. This model is all the supersymmetry is completely broken on the brains. So the spectrum, which I showed you here in this table, it's really completely non-supersymmetric. So these are only fermions, and there are no supersymmetric partners which go along with this. And I will discuss a few problems in there and how to cure them in just a minute. There are also Higgs fields. I just mentioned it here, namely this method now then was also further investigated by the Spanish group, Ibanez, Marchesano and Ravadan, and they pushed it a little bit further, but they used precisely these methods. Namely, they showed that it is indeed possible to get precisely just the standard model at intersecting brain. So they found this choice of four stacks of D6 brains. And again, after investigating the anomalies in the U1 sector, they showed that the gauge group is now precisely given by the gauge group of the standard model. There are again three generations of quarks and leptons, including a right-handed neutrino. There's a Higgs sector similar to the minimal supersymmetric standard model. In fact, you get two Higgs doublets in, for this choice, which one should also include then in the table. And they also discussed the question of proton stability. And one of the anomalous groups here is U1B minus L. And this is, in fact, welcome because this guarantees the proton stability for this class of models, at least if the string scale is high enough. No, this is a new model. With this, which model do you mean?
U3 times U2 times U2 times
U1. Okay. Yeah. Okay, I told you there are four U1s. Two of them are anomaly free. One combination is this one, and the other one I didn't write down. So there is another U1, which is, so to say, a spectator U1.
Oh, okay.
Yeah? So you have two massless U1s at the end.
And where's weak hypercharge?
Weak hypercharge, then you have to go to the phenomenology of this model. I mean, the gauge group is given by this left-right symmetric gauge group, and hypercharge is a combination of the T3R plus U1 B minus L, as usual.
Okay, and the extra U1
is the gauge group? Yes, precisely. A spectator gauge boson in this case. Okay. They're all non-supersymmetric. They're also completely non-supersymmetric. It's a standard model, a non-supersymmetric standard model with two Higgses, precisely. Okay. But now being non-supersymmetric, there arises, of course, the important issue of stability, which is rather generic for non-supersymmetric string compactifications. It's the first issue which you should address is whether there are tachyons or not in the spectrum. And in fact, it can be shown that for a wide range of the parameters, namely of the radii R1 and R2, you can choose the torus in such a way that all would-be tachyons are massive. So for a wide range of parameters, there are no tachyons in the spectrum, which is fine. The next question which you should address, this is something which we are working on at the moment, is the question of further tadpoles. So far we have discussed the so-called Ramon tetpoles, they are crucial for anomaly freedom, so they are really a consistency requirement which you should never give up, of course. But then there could be also tetpoles in the Neve-Schwarz sector, and these tetpoles generate a generic instability. And one can show easily that usually, generically, these tetpoles already arise at the topology of the world sheet disk amplitudes. And if you look at these amplitudes, you will see that there are two types of closed string tetpoles. And first, there's a Villatron tetpole, which is essentially given by the volume of the brains minus the volume of the orientifold plane, which tells you that there's, so to say, unbalanced tension usually due to the non-supersymmetric nature of the models. And this unbalanced tensor essentially wants to pull together the brains, as you will see. And then there is also a so-called geometry tetpole, or more precisely, they are the so-called complex structure tetpoles, namely also the complex structure fields, the complex structure moduli, which are essentially given by the quotient of the radii R2 over R1, acquire a tetpole. The specific form is not so important now. And it is nice to see that all these tetpoles can be written or can be formulated or arise if you compute the following scalar potential, which is again essentially the volume of all the brains minus the volume of the orientifold planes. And then you see that the tetpoles are nothing else than the first derivative, the minima of this scalar potential. And in fact, this scalar potential is nothing else than the Born-Infeld action for these denying brains, where you plug in here the background parameters and integrate over the internal dimensions. Yeah, that is the question precisely, what happens with these tetpoles. They do shift the vacua. So the meaning of this Neve-Schwarz tetpoles is you have to look just at the minimum of the potential. And for example, for the geometry, you will see that they shift the geometry in such a way that all the complex structures are infinite. This is a typical runaway behavior which you might know from supersymmetry breaking in string theory. Or in other words, the brains which intersect at certain angles due to their tensions are pulled together, that they want to make the torus completely degenerate, where all the brains here lie along the X1 axis, and hence the system is dynamically driven or flows towards the large complex structure limit, where also at a certain point the tachyons are met again. And this is now really bad news, because first you thought that you have chosen your torus in such a way that the tachyons are absent, but then you are dynamically pushed away to the regime where the tachyons reappear. So in other words, the non-supersymmetric toroidal compacting equations, as they are presented right now, are completely unstable. They have a Dillerton tetpole and also these geometry tetpoles. And let us think about a way to get rid of at least the geometry tetpoles. The Dillerton tetpole will not be cured. The Dillerton tetpole, by the way, will drive the theory to very weak coupling. This is also the typical runaway behavior. So one possible way out would be, for example, to the Fischler-Susskind mechanism, where you cure the problem in next order of perturbation theory. But this means that you have, this is essentially the back reaction of the tetpoles on your geometry. And this is a little bit complicated, therefore we thought about a different way, namely to just freeze out the complex structure fields as dynamical fields, which can be done by dividing the toroidal model by some discrete orbifold symmetry. So instead of considering the standard oriented fold, we divide the type 2b on a T6 also by this orbifold group. And okay, I don't want to enter the discussion now. The procedure goes in the same way as I have shown you before. And we looked at various possibilities. And again, for G equals 3, Tachyon free three generation models with standard model gauge group can be again constructed. So the upshot is that you get non-supersymmetric string work here in this way, which have certain nice phenomenological features. Of course, not everything is perfect, as life is usual, but they have attractive features, and they are at least also stable with respect to the geometry, at least in this order of perturbation theory. Yes, we stabilize indeed all the geometry moduli, at least at the disk level. Of course, if you go higher loop in open string amplitudes, possibly you will again encounter certain tadpoles. But the statement at this order, all tadpoles are absent. Sorry? No, it's no guarantee that there are, but there are some arguments that there might not, but or that at higher order there is not this runaway behavior which drives you again back to the degeneration limit. But this is still open for discussion, I think. Okay. For the gauge group, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. You get rid of the other U1s, which are there because you have UN factors by this Green-Schwarz mechanism. Right. Okay, so this was the story about type 1 compactification, and I want to change a little bit subject now in the remaining time. Of course, the subject is not completely unrelated. We have seen that generically turning on these fluxes, these gauge field fluxes, in type 1 compactification, say, the theory becomes unstable, and generically you are driven back to the supersymmetric point, to the supersymmetric vacuum, where all brains again lie on top of each other. And as you will see, something similar will also now happen if we now discuss these H fluxes in type 2B or type 2A compactivications on Calabi-Yau threefolds. So let me remind you first about a few formulas which you have seen before also in the talk by Ken this morning. We have, say, type 2B on a Calabi-Yau W with Ramond and Neve-Schwarz three-form fluxes in this way, which means that you integrate these fields over the so-called B and AI three cycles, where the index I runs from 0 to H to 1. And then the induced four-dimensional superpotential is given by the integral over omega, the holomorphic three-form, wedged with precisely these internal H fields. And if you perform this integration, you get this expression. You have here the complex flux vectors EI and MI, which depend on the complex type 2B coupling constant tau. So EI and MI are given by these two expressions. And the XI and the FI are nothing else than the period, which are given by the integral of omega over MI or respectively BI, which are the well-known objects which appear in special geometry. A similar superpotential also arises in the type 2A compactification on the, say, on the mirror manifold M. Here we have Ramond fields of even degree, H6, H4, and H2. And these Ramond field strengths, you can integrate over the whole space M. You can integrate them over the four cycles and the two cycles. Formally, you can also introduce a zero form, H0, integrate it over points of the Calabi-Yau, and then you get an extra integer number n0, and the induced four-dimensional superpotential is again given by now the integral of the Ramond fields H n matched with the Kähler form J of a certain power 3 minus n. Note a little difference here, which is I think important and still unsolved issue. Namely, for the the type 2b case with three-form fluxes, the flux vectors are complex because here it's the sum of the Ramond and the Neuville-Schwarz fluxes, where in the 2a sector the flux vectors are real integers. So somehow, not only somehow, one is missing the mirror image of the Neuville-Schwarz type 2b fluxes in the type 2a case, a problem which was also asked in the previous talk. And I think it would be very interesting to see what is really the precise meaning of the Neuville-Schwarz fluxes in the corresponding 2a mirror compactification. Okay, these superpotentials generically break the n equals 2 supersymmetry, which is preserved by the compactification without the fluxes, completely. However, at certain so-called attractor points in the modulized space, n equals 2 supersymmetry can be unbroken. So this is precisely the, so to say, the instability also we talked about before. And this precisely happens if the fluxes are aligned to be dual to some of the vanishing cycles. We call them Cn, and it's the dimension of the cycle V of the Calabi-Yau. So in this case, the superpotential is given by some flux or field strengths of degree 6 minus m times the dual volume of the cycle. And since the volume is shrinking to zero size, the superpotential goes to zero, which means that supersymmetry is unbroken. And this phenomenon can be now studied for several cases. For example, it happens at the large volume limit. It happens also at the so-called conifold point, which was first discussed by Polchinski and Strominger. So let us quickly look what is happening at the conifold point, say in first in type 2b language. At the conifold point, there you have a vanishing three cycle in the corresponding period. Mu is just given by the ratio of, say, x1 over x0, which goes to zero, and the dual flux is given by e1, where e1 is now integrated over the, not over the vanishing cycle, of course, but the cycle which is dual, which is transversal to the vanishing cycle. The corresponding superpotential is very simply then given just by e1 times e mu. Now you can compute the supergravity potential by the standard formulas, which arises from the superpotential. It has this form, and you see that indeed supersymmetry is preserved at the minimum, and in fact the supersymmetric point is really the attractor point. It is the true minimum of the potential. In other means, that the theory is attracted, it flows back to the conifold point where supersymmetry is preserved. In 2A language, it means, so this is a mirror picture of the conifold in 2B, that the whole quantum volume of the Calabi-Yau M shrinks. So then the superpotential is given by this little bit obscure number N0 times the volume of M, and a similar analysis applies. I come now to the field theory limit. So far we did not talk about the field theory limit. We are just at the conifold point, which is, so to say, a simple limit where only one parameter shrinks. Yes. Well, I mean, you're talking about partial Fuzzy breaking, or what is your question about? Yeah. Yeah, obviously, from mu equal non-zero, supersymmetry is completely broken. And this also is true if you don't, if you choose flux vectors which are not aligned with respect to some vanishing cycles. But now, if you do precisely this alignment of flux and vanishing cycles, you will see that your minimum of the potential preserves supersymmetry again. So this is what we mean saying that supersymmetry is generically broken. First, for generic flux vectors, supersymmetry will be broken. And second, also at a generic point in the modulized space, clearly supersymmetry is broken from n equals 0, excuse me, from n equals 2 to n equals 0. Okay, now comes this question about the field theory limit, which is, I think, also relevant for, say, for example, this large n duality of Wafer and Trilligator and others. So let us ask ourselves what is happening at the field theory point, if you wish, the Seiberg-Witten point of pure SU2 Young-Mills field theory. And again, it comes out now you have to perform a double scaling limit. I don't want to go into the details of the analysis. It becomes a little more complicated. But it turns out that a certain two cycle shrinks to zero size plus a certain four cycle. So the volume of the two cycle is denoted by T, and the volume of the four cycle is denoted by the derivative of the pre-potential with respect to another modulus called S. As you recognize also now expressions of the previous speaker. In fact, we did this analysis for a two-parameter model where S and T are the only modulizers. There's a certain Calabi-Yau of degree 12, which can be written as a K3 vibration. And then S is the modulus of the basis, of the volume of the basis P1, and T is some fiber modulus, but this is not so important. The dual fluxes for this volume is a Ramond two form, and we normalize it to be, say, M over 2. And interestingly enough, you need also, again, this little bit mysterious Nibbe-Schwarz 4 form. Here I think there's a little disagreement of our analysis with the paper of Taylor and Wafer, where they only discuss this piece of the vanishing cycle. So I think you need also already here some kind of Nibbe-Schwarz fluxes in the 2A description. And the superpotential is now again given by the flux times the vanishing cycle, which we denote by pi. This is also now somehow standard notation. Namely, in fact, this pi is again is nothing else than the adjoint mass term in the corresponding SU2 Young-Mills theory, the mass term for the adjoint field, which breaks now n equals 2 to n equals 1. So in field theory now, this is an example of partial supersymmetry breaking, where n equals 1 supersymmetry is preserved. Now you can turn on the machinery, you compute the periods at this Seiberg-Witten point, compare them with the periods in the flux spaces. You need for that a certain matrix. It becomes a little bit more technical. And at the end, you get such a scalar potential, I think, which we should not really look at more closely, but instead we can look at a picture. We have plotted the scalar potential, and the only important thing is that, again, it shows a unique minimum. The theory is driven, the minimum is here at the central point, and the theory dynamically, the supergravity theory, is dynamically driven to this Seiberg-Witten point, which is, I think, of course, nice and consistent. Namely, it tells you that the field theory point where you have to do this decoupling, this double scaling limit, is indeed a stable minimum of the supergravity potential, which preserves n equals 2 symmetry. And in fact, if you freeze out the string coupling constant, this is a little subtle point, then partial supersymmetry breaking to n equals 1 is possible. In other words, I think it makes sense to study the field theory dynamics by replacing now the compact Calabi-Yau, and we talk only so far about compact Calabi-Yaus, by the non-compact Calabi-Yau, which describes the neighborhood of this singularity. And then you come precisely to the issue what Ken was discussing in the previous talk, namely the issue of the large N duality, namely that the type 2B, say, on a non-compact Calabi-Yau with fluxes is dual to N D3 brains on some singularity. The issue of confining gauge theories of Polchinski and Strassler. And you are using now precisely the same superpotential as before. You have here this mass term, which comes, which corresponds to this piece here. And also, in type 2B, you can include now the Gaugino condensate by the fluxes of the Neuville-Schwarz reform. Again, as it was questioned or asked before already, if you want to map this picture to 2A, which is certainly possible, then arises this subtle issue. What is the meaning of the alpha of the Neuville-Schwarz flux in the 2A picture? I think I don't complete it, I do not completely understand it, but apparently it is understandable. Okay, so finally, if I have a few more minutes, I want to pose at the end the question whether these type 2 descriptions, the type 2 H fluxes, can be also mapped, so to say, to the heterotic side using the heterotic type 2 duality, which was formulated some time ago, first by Kahu and Buffer, I guess. So let us ask the question whether the heterotic type 2 string duality is preserved by turning on the H or the F fluxes, something which we did recently with Curio, Albrecht Lem, and Boris Kurz. And for this, we make now the little assumption we are in the type 2A context that the Calabi-Yau N is a K3 vibration over a base P1. And then we will use the adiabatic principle, which I guess you know, to map the situation over to the heterotic side. Namely, so let's start first with the type 2A picture. And there we get two types of Ramond H fluxes, namely one class of fluxes which do involve this basis P1. So the 6-form integrated over the whole space M, the 4-form integrated over P1 times a two-dimensional cycle in K3, and also a flux which is denoted by M1, which is just the 2-form integrated over the base P1. So these are fluxes which involve the P1. And in fact, these fluxes can be seen as gauge fluxes of a 6-dimensional compactification of 2A on K3, where we further then integrate the 6-dimensional gauge fields on this P1. And then, second, there are also H fluxes which do not involve the P1, namely the 4-form integrated over K3, 2-form integrated over 2 cycles of K3, and also this flux M0. And in fact, you see these are fluxes which already exist in 6 dimensions as integral topological numbers. And they arise in the so-called massive 2A theory, which was first discussed by Romans and then also by other people like Pope and Lü and others, and also recently by Hug, Lewis, and Singh. So these are fluxes which are already there in 6 dimensions and correspond to the so-called massive supergravity theories. And now we compare this on the heterotic side, where the heterotic string is compactified on K3 times a T2, which is denoted by C for constant torus, where the K3 now is again our T2 fiber vibration over the same base P1. Now on the heterotic side, this compactification again can be seen as going first to 6 dimensions on the product of these two tori, and then further down on the same P1 as on the type 2 side, on the same P1 as in the type 2 side to 4 dimensions. So again, we get 6-dimensional gauge fields on the heterotic side, which are denoted by the graviphoton, one gauge field associated to the dilaton, and gauge fields associated to the moduli of the tori. And these six-dimensional gauge fields then can provide internal gauge field fluxes by integrating them over the P1 sphere. In fact, you get these four types of heterotic fluxes. And now, if you analyze the situation, these F fluxes on the heterotic side are precisely dual to the 2A H fluxes, which involve the integration over the same P1. And this can be seen very easily by using the adiabatic principle. So these fluxes are nicely mapped by the string duality symmetry, and one can further prove this, so to say, by comparing the effective action which is induced by the fluxes, say the scalar potential or the corresponding Green-Schwarz terms in the four-dimensional action, where the Green-Schwarz term is again of the form B wedge F4, and they induce a mass for one particular U1 gauge field, but note that these P1 fluxes are not associated to chiral fermions as it was before, so there's no chirality generated by these fluxes we discuss at the moment. But now comes, if you wish, the bad news, namely if you consider those two A fluxes which do not involve the P1, you simply cannot find them on the heterotic side. So apparently these fluxes break the heterotic type 2 string duality. In other words, it is not possible to get these massive type 2a supergravity in six dimensions via some heterotic compactification. So the origin really lies already in six dimensions. But even worse, you can also now consider alternative flux on the heterotic side, namely where you integrate the six-dimensional gauge fields not over the P1, but over the torus, which is also possible. So you get on the heterotic side these toroidal fluxes, and these generate now indeed chiral fermions and again anomalous U1s. But now these fluxes are not present on the type 2a side. And they are again in conflict, apparent conflict with the heterotic type 2a string duality. So the upshot is, one should not perhaps claim too much here at this point, but it looks like that the string duality symmetry looks like being broken by turning on these fluxes. And I think it's an interesting question how to reconcile this duality. So let me just quickly conclude the talk. Namely, in the first part we discussed Taiwan compactifications with magnetic internal magnetic gauge fields. So if you wish, compactification on a non-commutative torus, which was dual to intersecting brains, which are wrapped around cycles of the dual torus. And we discussed how to obtain a standard model with three generations, and so on. And then in the second part, we were looking at the type 2 heterotic string duality. And as we discussed briefly at the end, this duality holds for a subset of fluxes. Certain H fluxes can be mapped to certain heterotic F fluxes, but is apparently broken by other type of fluxes. So again, what is the meaning of these fluxes in the dual string picture? And moreover, I also again like to remind you about a similar problem, perhaps, namely, what is the dual of the type 2B and S3 form fluxes in 2A? And I think clearly this is important for the whole discussion of large N dualities, because the Gugino condensate relies on this, and also what is, so to say, the lifting of all this to M theory. Thanks.
Questions? Can we calculate in some of the cases of this type 2 with the fluxes, can we calculate the spectrum for certain models?
Yes, to some extent you can. You do it now essentially in the effective field theory. You have your superpotential. You analyze with the superpotential what happens, what field get mass. So if you, for example, look at the spectrum of Gaginos, of scalar masses, you do it essentially in the effective field theory context. But you know also some a little bit more. You can compute these chiral indices. You can also, in particular for toroidal fluxes, where you really can construct the spectrum, you can compute tachyon states and so on. So it can be done. We didn't really work it out, but certainly it can be done. I mentioned this at the beginning. Well, it was written on the transparency at the beginning.